any of us who've been in it for long enough, our entire career has been littered with jobs that we didn't get, projects that we thought were going to go for sure, dozens of unproduced scripts littering the floor.
All of us are running into both major and minor failures in Hollywood every single day.
For every success, there is months, sometimes even years, of painful failure.
This is one of the only businesses I can think of where failure is the default. That's the norm. You have to be able to persevere.
Like everything in our business, your hands get calloused and it all bounces off you. That process takes years. That doesn't happen overnight.
I was being told by my manager, it's yours to lose. And I promptly lost it. And I remember thinking like, well, that's it for me. I blew my one big shot. What I've realized from that moment is it's never one big shot. There will be other shots.
Screaming into the Hollywood Abyss is brought to you by Scriptation, the Emmy award-winning app that instantly transfers your notes into new drafts in seconds. Scriptation allows you to digitally mark up scripts, separate notes into layers, track changes across revisions, and so much more. Insert Noah saying something nice about Scriptation.
Dan, I think this is where they actually want me to talk about how much I love it. And I do love it. It's great. Its collating function transformed me from the messiest writer in Hollywood to, well, ever so slightly less messy. My wife might have other things to say about that. Scriptation listeners can get a free month of Scriptation by going to scriptation.com/Scriptation.
For those of you who don't understand slightly drawly American accents, that's scriptation.com/SITHA. Welcome back to Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, a podcast about rejection, failure, and adversity in the entertainment industry. I am, as ever, your non-entertainment co-host, Dan Rutstein.
And I am your still in the entertainment business co-host, Noah Evslin. On today's podcast, I'm thrilled to introduce TV writer, showrunner, and executive producer, Ashley Michael Hoban, who's written on such shows as Happy, The Girl from Plainville, and Dr. Death, which she's currently now the showrunner of. Season 2 of Dr. Death premieres on Peacock today. Welcome, Ashley.
Thank you. Today. Exciting.
So, obviously, not, you know, this is a rejection, failure, and adversity podcast, and we will go deep as we always do. But just because there's a show coming out tonight or today, depending on when you watch television, let's talk about that briefly before we get into
Sure.
Like, tell us about sort of the show, but also how you got to the show.
Yes. So, I mean, we don't know yet. This also might be a precursor to another failure story that the show is coming out tonight. You know, you never know how people are going to take it. But so I worked on season one under Patrick McManus, who was running that show and created the show for the first season. And when we were kind of, you know, setting up what the second season was going to be, this story really spoke to me. And Patrick is very busy and working on a lot of things. And he had been in France, actually. He was in France with his family for a year. His wife was doing her master's in social work there. So he was like, you know, do you want to take this over? And I said, let me think about it. No, I immediately said, absolutely. I've been really, you know, this has been the goal of my life. And I still kind of am pitching myself that I get to do it, to be honest.
So we had Patrick on this podcast. And his story is, he had a good failure story. Like there was, I think, you know, flying half around the world to get away from his wife, not in a good way.
Yes.
Sleeping in offices. Like it was real. And I think I like these stories where somebody moves aside and gives somebody else sort of a chance to showrun. When you get, obviously, showrunning is a huge achievement and it's a great opportunity. When it's a show you've already been on and the person who was doing it before, you know, they haven't been cancelled or sacked, they've just sort of stepped aside and everyone liked them. Does that make
How do you now approach this? Are you just sort of trying to do what he was doing and, you know, do it your way? Or, like, I don't know if it makes it harder when you're replacing somebody good.
I think it makes it easier because you got to learn. I mean, you learn from the good behaviors and the bad behaviors that you see. But with Patrick, anyone that's met him knows that he is basically 99.9% good behavior. So there's always that little bit. But I've been by his side for, you know, a decade. So I have watched him do this job for a really long time. And you know, it was also not a given, you know, the idea of pitching out to Universal and pitching out to Peacock, you know, there was always a world where they said, no, you know, we don't like your take or whatever. So I don't know. I am truly the luckiest lady in all of Hollywood. Like, I honestly believe that because I met him at such a pivotal time in my life and the exact right time to be able to kind of crawl into his orbit and stick with him and keep bothering him about whatever the next thing is. I mean, should I kind of like walk through my, like, I mean, I was his assistant. That's how we met originally. So I can kind of start there, but
I can set you up. I can set you up because I feel like this is you have an awesome, where we are at the climax of your story, which is this,
yes,
the showrunner, which is amazing. Yeah. That's because the people listening are going to want to hear this journey, especially those who it's taken them a long time to get their first break. Let's rewind you.
Yeah.
Back, okay, cool, to the beginning where you were like, not, yeah, it would, like, if this was a movie, it would say, you know, 10 years earlier or whatever, title appears, and you are an assistant. And, you know, talk about the struggles too, about, you know, maybe, you know, because, you know, you've made it, the audience knows you've made it, but, like, was there a time where you didn't think you were going to get that next job or get out of the assistant ranks?
I feel my blood pressure rising, because just that it's the most, being right on the edge of something is, like, for me, it was the most anxiety filled time of my life, you know, not knowing. I'm from Cleveland. I grew up in a family of pest control exterminators. So I did not, you know, I was coming into this world as naive as possible, first of all, but also, you know, without a single way in that I could see. And so I moved to New York and I was trying to make, you know, the next great film. I'm like, with my crappy DSLR. And then when I finished graduate school, I got a job as an assistant editor on a show called Marco Polo. And that's when I first met Patrick. But I also direct. So my focus at the time was I really wanted to get into directing. And particularly I was excited about writing for TV and directing for TV. And so I just happened to be assistant editing on the episodes of the producing director, Dan Minahan, who needed an assistant. And so that's how I first kind of fell into the assistant world. Cause that was like, I thought that was going to be it. I was like, as soon as I get a job as an assistant, that's my big Hollywood break. And then everything's just going to fall into place. And boy, oh boy, was I wrong. So after, you know, this first season premiered of Marco Polo, and then the second season was coming, and Dan called me and said, you know, do you want to go with us on production for season two and continue as my assistant? And I was like, absolutely. And he was like, I just want to make sure that you understand what you're getting yourself into leaving home for 8 months and traveling to, you know, we got to travel to some amazing places, but it was a very difficult show. And I was 100% on board. I feel like I have put everything else in my life to the side, you know, in pursuit of the job. So, so that was a no-brainer for me. And it's while we were on set in first Budapest and then Malaysia is where, you know, I kind of got to know Patrick better and John Fusco, who is the creator. And then by the end of that production, I was assisting all three of them. Because I'm greedy, and also that because it was cheaper. Because I would do it. I was like, I'll do it all. So, you know, that was the beginning of my relationship, particularly with Patrick, that has defined my entire career. And I'm really lucky. Honestly, I'm really lucky. He was running this for the first time as his first job, show running, and so, you know, they had obviously already done a season, but that show was really hard. It was, you know, 8 months, and it was two units running all the time. There was never a point in the week where we weren't working. So, I don't know. It was sort of a little bit like file by fire. And I somehow made it through.
Well, I'll leave Dan to ask the question about the moment where you made it through, but because I have a very granular question that's asked a lot when you're an assistant. I get asked, you know, I've been working on shows for a number of years, and assistants will talk to me about, like, when is the right time? Now, this is a weird dance you do, because all the person who hired you knows you're a writer, right? They know you want to be a writer. They know you are a writer. When is the right time in a situation when you're working for three people who can change your career and change your life? Just present them with material. Did they approach you? Did you approach them? What was their response? What was the pre-staffing journey that you have? Mm-hmm. They looked at your material and said, you're awesome, or you're great, but these are the things you can work on. Was there, you know, talk about that a little bit.
So it was really hard for me to learn the lesson that you're assuming that everyone around you knows your greater ambition. And I was actually like, oh, I actually have to tell people, oh, I want to be a writer. So then once you do that, once you make that step, which was for some reason difficult for me to get to on my own, I had a misconception about how the industry worked. I thought it was like, I could just work my way up and then I'll be able to write scripts. And I honestly, it's so silly to say it now. I didn't understand that. It's like, I should be writing all of the time. And Patrick was the one that was like, you know, you should be writing all of the time. You should be writing pilots. You should be writing specs. You should be doing whatever you need to do to practice. And so it really wasn't until he brought me on as the writer's assistant for season 3 of Marco Polo, which never got made. And it was then that I was like, he's like, you know, you're never going to get staffed if you don't have a bunch of samples. And he's the kind of guy that can just sit down, it seems, and write. And, I think I'm the kind of writer, like most writers, where it's the hardest thing to get into the seat. That's the hardest part, is sitting down to do it. So it was during that room that I started writing just terrible pilots all over the place. And I wrote, you know, I think 3 or 4 during that time, which then I showed him and he gave me feedback on. I showed his sister, who had worked in development. She wasn't working in development at the time. She's obviously come back to run his company now, Littleton Road Productions. But at the time she was working for Fila. She gave me notes. I was giving it to people who I trusted. And I don't think I realized how good I had it with the kind of notes I was getting back. And these were never going to be things that sold, you know. This was like samples that I can write. This isn't like, I never thought of these as like, and then I'll sell this show. I have yet to sell a show. In fact, even Dr. Death was, you know, it was, I didn't really sell that. So did that answer your question? I feel like I
really did. You did.
Okay. I'm talking in circles. My goodness.
I'm going to be slightly careful here, because I don't really, because I'm not in the industry, which is obviously sort of good. But also means I don't fully understand exactly how it all works. But I'm assuming that there were plenty of time where being an assistant, it's a sort of job where you do a lot of different things, and it's sort of whatever it is they need you to do. But presumably there were times where, you know, you were doing things that are, I guess, how do you manage that sort of like thing where, like, yeah, here's your coffee, and by the way, here's my script, or sort of, you know, yes, I've booked this thing that you need booking. Oh, by the way, you know, I think you could have done this slightly differently by, you know, having this character do that and the other. Did you find yourself sort of holding yourself back and sort of having to remind yourself that today the job you need to do is make their life easier and not make your career more successful?
Yes, absolutely. I don't know. I think I'm a little too shy to kind of come out that way. I want to say I was so impatient in my soul, but I couldn't. It just felt like I think I knew I also wasn't ready to be doing anything meaningful anyway at the time. On some level, I knew I wasn't ready to be writing yet, because I had so much left to learn, as I still do. But it's hard to be like, I feel like I should be staffed right now and I'm getting coffee. It's a really difficult thing in your ego that's hard to overcome. But excuse me, there's also, sorry, that press junk yesterday, I'm losing my voice. There's something in, helping them do their jobs well, that and making yourself indispensable, that felt good. You know, making like being the person that they could consistently come to and know that something's going to get done. You know, I'll never forget the time I made it. I'll never forget, like, I have like a list of mistakes that I've made as an assistant in my head, because it's just like I just wanted to be everything for them and make myself indispensable, and then have it feel like, well, the only natural progression is to keep her on and have her write. And then, you know, I don't think that I had the normal assistant experience in the openness that John Fusco, Dan Minahan, and Patrick McManus had in letting me kind of talk about the work and ask my ideas. You know, it's like, who does that? So I don't know if that experience was normal, or what many people are going to experience, but, yeah, there was something there was an openness there. And obviously, you know, I'm sure I stuck my foot in my mouth approximately 1,000 times, and I'm sure I was the most annoying writer's assistant of all time, because I had been on set and I thought I knew, you know, I like knew the story front and back. By that time I had an associate producer credit, so I thought I was hot shit, but you know, yeah, I guess there's always that, like, that urge to kind of put yourself out there. You feel like you're ready. You feel like you're ready, and you just have to wait. And that patience is, oh my gosh, it's really hard, because it's patience, but it's also this thing in the back of your head that's like, oh my God. And then it might never happen. You can work and work and work. You can work really hard and you can be really good, and it can still never happen. And that idea was, and still is, by the way, still is very, very frightening to me. I am not the best writer that is out there in Hollywood, you know? And I worked hard, but I'm sure I'm not the hardest worker either. There's so much of it out of your control. And that's really frightening. And I don't know why we do this to ourselves, but we do.
Yeah, no, I think this is why I'm glad I don't work in Hollywood. Apart from like sneaking in, asking some questions in a podcast, and then going back to my slightly more normal job. So it sounds like you have had, compared to definitely some assistants in Hollywood, given all the things that go on in Hollywood, you definitely have been treated better than sounds like a lot of people. But I am sure there were still times either it wasn't perfect, or you saw other junior people not being necessarily treated amazingly. Now you're the grown up. How do you, and given the journey that you've been on, now you're working with, you know, compared to you, very junior people, how do you treat them? And are you sort of looking for the next you in terms of, is there somebody there who, you know, is your, almost your aim, but not necessarily, you know, if this show continues or you go on to another show, that you would then have one of your former assistants potentially replace you as a showrunner?
Oh my God, that would be so incredible. But yeah, you know, I think the biggest takeaway from being an assistant, working up the ladder, is, you know, we don't have to hate our lives while we do this. You know, this job is really hard. And we can, and kindness is really so much more important. We don't put enough import on the way we're treating each other. And I feel like I'm starting to sense this shift, especially, it's particularly on set, because like a writer's room is a sacred space. And if there's a lack of respect in the writer's room, like you're out. There are too many people on a crew to police everybody's behavior. But I do sense that there's this kind of shift toward the way we're treating each other. And I really, you know, I know what it feels like. I had to have an assistant. I had to have an assistant this season. And it felt so weird, because it feels like at any minute I could be doing that again. But I try to treat them the way that I was treated. I mean, listen, it all comes back to that one golden rule that our moms told us, which is that we should always be treating people the way we want to be treated, not the way we were treated.
I think we as I've been in the industry now 15 years, you know, almost maybe going on 20 years, the no assholes rule is definitely becoming
no more assholes. Popular.
But I have a question about your journey to showrunner on the page, where you were like, you know, you said, yeah. You know, I'm not the best writer, I'm not the hardest working, but I'm sure you're an awesome writer and I'm sure you're super hardworking, but it's a competitive, you know, we're competing, and it's, I'm always saying you're only competing with yourself, but there's, the pool is small and a lot of people want to get into it. But my question to you is, like, you worked with Patrick for a number of years, you know, going up the ranks. And at what point in all of this, if ever, did you feel like as you were turning in drafts that your bar was rising, that you got it, that you weren't getting rewritten as much, or Patrick was seeing something in you? Did you talk about it, or did you just notice a shift in the drafts you were turning in? Like on a craft level, when did you feel like you were getting to the point where you could be able to run the show?
I think, you know, he had me co-write a couple of second episodes in the seasons. And that, I think, felt like, okay, I'm tapping into something in the voice of the show. And then that kind of, like, I was thinking back, you know, it takes a minute to get into the voice of the show. And I think accessing that, I think I'm okay at that. And I'd like to think that, you know, when he gave me, like, we were splitting second scripts down, you know, down the season. So split a second script in The Girl from Plainville, and I split a second script on Death season one. And that was that felt good, because it was like, okay, it felt like an acknowledgement that, that I could tap into something in the voice of the show. Maybe I don't know that. I mean, I don't know that I'm ever getting rewritten less. I don't know about that. You know, I don't know. I worked on a show, The Beauty and the Beast prequel show with Adam Horowitz, Eddie Kitsis, and Josh Gad. It never went, which that was the moment where it was like, if that show's not going, I don't know what Hollywood is. But, you know, they let me do like 8 drafts of my script before we turned it in. And that was like an incredible experience, because, you know, they were the third or fourth showrunners I had worked with. And it was a different style. Obviously everything was different. And actually maybe it's that moment. Maybe that was the moment where it was like, after that experience, I got to learn so much from that experience and having them give me so many rounds of notes and letting me do it. And so I'm just taking it away. Cause I get it. It's easier just to say, I'm going to do it. You know, because it's, I had a conversation with a friend recently who actually was on Marco Polo, Matt White. He's one of the writers. This was a while ago, actually. He was one of the writers on Dr. Death as well. And he stayed on set with me to produce the season. And he said, I remember ages ago, he had said something like, it feels like you've spent so much time as the writer, as the episodic writer, you spend all of this time and energy finding the exact perfect word. And then the showrunner takes it as like, fixed it. Yeah. And I was like, actually, it feels like that. But in reality, it's that you already know kind of what you want anyway. And the process of getting another writer there is hard, and it's not always given. The opportunity isn't always given to people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's something that I'm on staff. It's something that as someone on staff, you struggle with every day, trying to fulfill the showrunners, get to the showrunner's voice.
Yeah.
What you think they're going to do on the page. But sort of back to sort of a success and failure question. This is a simpler question. You've had 2 pivotal moments in your life, I think, because you were an assistant for a while. You got staffed, and that was a huge moment in your life. And then you were on staff for a while and you became the showrunner. Of those 2 moments, becoming a staff writer, which is your coming out party, you know, and becoming a showrunner, which is a whole other coming out party, you know, what was the better feeling? Run us through those emotions.
Oh my goodness. I cried on both occasions. I can say that. I was with a few friends when I got the call that the contract had gone through, that the deal was done on Death, and I just wept. And then that was embarrassing. But I would say the getting staffed felt like, okay, Okay. And by the way, I did, you know, I got staffed on the second season of Happy, and I had been producing on the show. So I stayed on for production in the first season or in the second season as well. But then I had to assist after that. I had to go back to assisting because I couldn't get another job. So, until Patrick came back, I think it was after that it was Death One, I think. Yeah. So yeah, that felt really good. But I also had that thing in the back of my mind where I knew a lot of my friends got staffed and then 2 years went by and they didn't get staffed again. And that was scary. And so, yeah, I did end up having to go back, and I was assisting a line producer in New York on FBI Most Wanted.
I'm slightly irritated that Noah asked a good question because that normally happened, and now I feel slightly under pressure. So,
Boy.
So it's Thursday. The show that in a second season drops today, you're the showrunner. Now, you know, it's not like in the, you know, in the movies where you got your box office numbers and so on, but it's going to drop. Presumably, you'll get hundreds of text messages and emails from sort of friends and all that congratulating you. When you wake up tomorrow morning, what happens next in terms of, you know, there's going to be some obviously immediate feedback, but then there's also sort of if it's good, then you're sort of, what do I do next?
Yeah.
It's not good. There's sort of, what do I do now? But also it's sort of, you know, going to be talked about. You're going to be talked about. What do you sort of do? How are you expecting tomorrow to go?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know if you guys have experienced this, but I feel like after every show wraps or releases or whatever, I fall into this really dark place. I fall into like a really deep depression. And I like sometimes, like after The Girl from Plainville, like I think I didn't like leave the house for 2 weeks straight. I feel like there's a little bit of like a loss of it. And you're right. It's like, if it does well, it's like, what's next? And if it doesn't do well, it's like, what is next? What am I going to do? You know? You know, and I think our brains are, you know, writing is work and it takes practice and you get better and worse at it. You know, you can fall out of practice of everything. And so I think trying to run right into the next thing would be the ideal, but like, I'm going to be honest with you. I feel like there's a 90% chance I turn on the first episode of Buffy and just like sit on the couch and like panic and, you know, and go to the dark place. And that's, I will try not to, but yeah, I don't know. I guess trying to keep the momentum, not just like whatever people, you know, hopefully people like the show and hopefully there's momentum in the show, but the momentum of kind of like my personal momentum is the thing that's always the hardest, you know, keeping yourself going and not falling off and sort of then having to wind yourself back up to get back into that mindset. You know, I was, after Plainville wrapped, I didn't know what was going to be next. You know, you never know where your money's coming from. I had just gotten a new place. So there was a lot of that pressure. And so, you know, and it took me a long time after that kind of weird darkness to get my brain back into a lucid place then to try to pitch a show, you know, to pitch a show. So I feel like it's that race forward. I guess that's the kind of the ideal tomorrow morning is I want to wake up and write something. And even if I don't, you know what? You guys have done it. I am going to write 10 pages tomorrow. Just kidding. I'm going to write 2 pages tomorrow of something, a pitch, a pilot, something.
Obviously, careers are funny things because, you know, to Noah's question, there's a point where you're like, I've become a staff writer. This is great. This is what I wanted to achieve. And then you're sort of in it. And then you're like, oh, right, now a showrunner. What comes next in terms of there's different ways of being a showrunner, obviously. There is what you're doing now, which is, you know, you're with a trusted family, as it were, where they've given you the chance, but it's not your show, but you've shown them that you can do it. What's the next sort of personal challenge for you? Is it your own show starting from scratch? Is it being asked to do the second or third season of another show, but not one where you're, you know, you were the assistant for the previous showrunner, you know, a completely new set of people where you're sort of starting it? Is it to not be a showrunner again, actually, and do something, maybe a bigger show, but you're the number two, or you're doing, or you're going to go off and do some directing? Like, what do you do next, do you think?
Directing is absolutely my next goal. I mean, I really love it. And I kind of, there was a choice. I remember consciously early on that I was like, okay, I can either pursue directing and then try to shift into a writer's room. But I kind of, you know, I knew that the writer's room is, it's a really hard place to get into. And so it's like, if I can do that, then I feel like it will be a little bit of an easier track over to directing. So directing next would be my big goal. And I don't know. It's whatever comes next, because, and I've always said this, and this is what I've always done. I don't know if this is right or wrong. I have never passed up a job. I take whatever comes next. I would love to staff again. I think that working, you know, I'm in a comfort zone place, and, you know, it's scary for me to go outside of the comfort zone, but I will admit that, like, Patrick and his company and Universal, that's a really comfortable place for me, and it's safe. And so the idea of working for a different, even a different studio is a scary thing. So that would be a personal challenge that, that I will hopefully have to face, because, you know, hopefully my career continues. But honestly, yeah, directing would be the next kind of dream big achievement. But getting any next job, you know, staffing or developing something, that's kind of, that step will feel like something good.
When you were a staff writer, and this is a common story, and not a common, like, your story is common, but we've heard it a few times on this podcast where people just don't get another job, and then they have to go back to being assistant, and it feels like such a failure, probably because you've made your dreams, and then you got to tell your parents or your friends, like, oh, by the way, I'm back to this thing. And then you make yourself back, you go back up, and the second job is always impossible. Now, you know, I made my way up the ranks, but I've never been showrunner. So what, like, you can't go from showrunner to assistant. You can't go from showrunner to folding shirts.
Watch me.
Like, I have to imagine there is no plan B anymore. There might be, like, co-EP, or sometimes they have to go to a different show. But, like, do you feel like at this point with Dr. Death, I've had friends who be like, when you make showrunner, it's like you're in a whole new ballgame. It's a whole new world. But I have to imagine there's way more fears, too, like, about what's next.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because then also, you know, you get used to... I think of myself as a pretty collaborative person. And I'd like to hope that the cast and crew agree with me. The idea of working for someone doesn't feel to me like a step down in a way. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that sounds insincere. I really actually mean that. Like, it doesn't seem like a step down, because I guess this is like my own, I don't know if you've noticed that I'm constantly functioning from a place of deep fear, but there's also a lot of there's a lot of self-doubt, and there's a lot of, I mean, imposter syndrome is a very deeply real thing, and I know that I have a lot more to learn about how to tell stories on television. So I don't think that it's like, if I'm not running something or I'm not developing something, that I've, like, taken a step back. I think, and that's probably partly the imposter syndrome talking about, like, did I really earn this to get here in the first place?
We've had other guests on here who've said the same thing, who've made it to showrunner, creator, and they're like, I was so ready to not be that the next time, because I did feel like I had things to learn, whether that was true or not. And then I went back for a few more shows, and then I went back up. And by then, it's like getting your reps in. You have to get your reps in.
Yeah. And that's exactly right.
It's a very different job. And do you feel like you were able to manage, you know, forget about that. We talked about writing a lot. So now this is normally a Dan question, but like the management side of being a showrunner, is that, were you good at that? Did you like that? Is that something that you're excited to do in future seasons?
Yes, I did. I did like it. I like it because, and this is something that Patrick did as well. I like being able to control everything. No, I like to be able to control the atmosphere. And when you are the manager, like you set the pace, you set the tone. And that was exciting to me because it was like, if this show is not fun and people are miserable, then that's my fault. And, which obviously is also a lot of pressure, but the idea of being able to, I think I'm pretty good at that side of things, like the producerial. I mean, the producerial side of my job is why I'm here now, because I was always, Patrick always kept me around because I could produce for him. And I shouldn't say for him, with him. But so that side of things always felt under control for me. And it was really more the creative stuff that felt like, can I do this? And can I do it well? Am I going to tell this story in a way that, you know, also, by the way, there's like this true crime thing is extra tricky because am I going to tell this story in a way that's going to make the families of the real people that I'm telling about, you know, feel good about the way that we're telling that story? Which is a bit of a burden that I think I put to the side a little bit. Like I think I sort of disconnected myself from that a little bit and thinking of them as characters and not people, which you kind of have to. Wow, I really just kind of went off on a tangent there. Yeah. Did that answer?
No, I love that.
No, okay.
No, it did indeed. Is it, no, you are an excellent guest, Ashley. I want to say this.
Oh, really?
I was having a difficult day. He's asking good questions and he's stealing my questions. So you're doing really well. And that's the important thing.
That's great. I'm disappointed in you, man.
Yeah. Happens a lot. I was going to ask a managerial sort of leadership question.
Yeah.
That's what I normally do, but I can't now because he has. So I'm actually going to ask, I guess it's a more specific question about the show. So when it was on this season, what's the one thing that nearly went the most wrong under your stewardship in terms of, you know, either a mistake you made or you nearly made but didn't quite? Was there a moment on this show where something bad nearly happened, but it was, I know it's a complicated world making these shows, but something that was maybe your fault or you could have done differently to stop something potentially happening?
Okay, so how much time do we have to record this? I mean mistakes probably every single day, but you know, right off the bat, I think there are a few. This is not like a huge one. This is a, like, easily fixable, but it was just like one of those things that it's like, you don't know what you don't know until you try it and you screw up. The very beginning, I don't know why I had this weird, like, I didn't want to share the pitch with the writers. And I was like, you guys are going to come in because there's already the podcast and we've got all this. They have like a trove of research from the Wondery podcast team. And I was like, I'm not going to share the pitch because I want you guys all to come in fresh. And I basically like wasted our first week of the writer's room, kind of just like, but, and they're like, but what do you think? And I was like, you know what? At the end of that first week, I was like, you guys, I'm going to give you the pitch. You should all read the pitch this weekend. And that was like, duh. Obviously you should give them the pitch to read because they need to know your take on the show. Otherwise we're just spinning in circles about everyone's take on the show. And that was just such a silly, stupid like thing to do that. I don't know what I thought was like, you know, everybody's going to come in fresh and everyone's going to have all these great ideas. One thing that I did that I made one mistake I made, and this was a bigger mistake that I couldn't correct, is I had it in my mind that we were going to do these two blocks of four episodes shooting at once. And that was a mistake. I wanted to limit the director, the amount of directors I had. And that was honestly, I can say this to you guys, like that was a complete control issue of mine. I didn't want to have four directors that I'd have to like micromanage. I don't think I'm a micromanager with the exception of maybe the director. I think you can ask Jennifer Morrison if she felt like I was micromanaging or getting a little bit too up in her space. that I because I direct and I have a, you know, I wanted it to be what it is in my head, but that's not why we do this. We do this to collaborate because that person's going to have an idea that you couldn't possibly have had. You know, I know all this emotion. I know all this in my mind. I just, you know, I'm having a hard time getting it into my soul. But so we hired these two directors and they were wonderful. And it was just so hard. It was so hard to do four episodes at a time. It was so hard for the actors to, especially, you know, Edgar Ramirez, who plays Dr. Death, he was in two different timelines. So he's, you know, it was difficult for the actors. It was difficult for the crew. It made production feel much longer. And that was a mistake that I hope the show didn't really suffer, but I know production did. And I think about that a lot.
Interesting. I almost feel obliged now to ask the opposite question. So obviously, yeah. I'm sure you're proud of the show as a whole, but is there one thing, and it might not be like a brilliant idea or concept, but is there one particular thing that you did during production or pre-production or post where, you know, it was something that you either managed or came up with or did differently that made a material difference that you can sort of, it's not about being boastful. There's something like, wow, I did that and it worked really well and I'm glad, yeah, I made that decision. Or, you know, people said I shouldn't do it and I stuck to my guns and it worked. Is there an opposite moment to what you've just discussed about something that you did really well?
Huh. No. you know, one of the episodes of the show is, it's episode 5 and it's sort of like a turning point in the arc of the season. And I had this idea at the very beginning of kind of conceiving how the show was going to go that I wanted to focus on one character and one victim, and then the doctor that's primarily taking care of her. And it's an important episode in the show for a lot of different reasons. And I had this idea that it's basically an entire episode of, it's like a montage of the entire episode, because you're telling a very long story in one episode of this girl's life. And that episode ended up being 84 scenes. And they were like, yeah, exactly. I just thought, no, go,
is that a lot or not enough?
It's a lot. Yeah. Like, I think average, it's like, I don't know, maybe between 30 and 40 realistically. And then we always end up with like something like 60 and we have to cut a bunch of stuff because we don't have time. So it was a lot of, and it was really demanding of the director, and it was incredibly demanding on Alicia Roser and Luke Kirby, the actors that were featured the most in that episode. But I'm glad that we stuck to it. And like, I think it was one of those things. It was like, yeah, we're going to keep pretending like we're going to do this. And then eventually it's going to fall apart and you're just going to have to like do this episode differently. But then we did it. And I'm really proud of not giving up, because that was a hard, that was a hard block to produce. That was a hard episode to produce. But that felt good. It was like, cause it was it was like one of the earliest ideas I had, and it felt like in my soul, like, this is important. This episode's important. It has to be this way. And I almost gave up a few times, but, I'm glad that we didn't. Cause I think people are gonna be into that episode. I think it's kind of special.
Oh, can't wait to watch it for starters, today.
Today!
You can start to watch it today. Well, thank you, Ashley. This is, you know, unfortunately, this is going to bring us to our last question.
Okay.
Ask every single person,
yes,
on this podcast that you might be prepared or you might not be prepared for this, but what is one piece of advice that you would give to somebody who's, you know, just entering this business as a writer? What would that be?
I have been thinking about this. for me, it's, there is no job beneath you. You know, there's no job in, honestly, even outside of the industry, that you can't glean something from, that you can't learn something from, that you can bring into either your writing or your storytelling, your producing, your directing, your acting, whatever. So I think you know, staying, it's easy to get worked up into that, the competitiveness of this industry and the anxiety of it and never knowing and trying and like just being on the edge and never making it. But, trying to step back and remember that everything that we're doing is all going to be, every experience that you have is all going to make you, a more layered storyteller. So I would say, yeah, go into assist the hell out of those producers and make yourself indispensable. You know, take something from every job. Nothing is every experience you can take something from.
Brilliant. Look, this has been a fascinating episode.
Really?
Yeah. No. You're not meant to be surprised by that. But your honesty in your answers. I know you. You've said a few times about the sort of imposter syndrome and anxiety around it. And obviously, of the 110 episodes we've had, I think probably half of the writers mm-hmm. have expressed yep. that like you have, and the other half probably should have done, but just didn't. but no, it's been fascinating having you on. I really appreciate, I know you're busy doing your sort of normal junkety things around this. And it's nice to have you come on and do the long form therapy session version of a junkie.
I was going to say, let me know what to bill you guys for the therapy session. And
But this has been great. I am sure the show will be incredibly well received today. And when you do wake up tomorrow morning, please email us to confirm that you did indeed write.
I did my 2 pages.
2 and 10 pages.
you guys are so great. This podcast is so important. So thank you for having me on.
Well, Ashley Michael Hoban, thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure to have you on our show.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Screaming Into the Hollywood Abyss, brought to you by Scriptation. Thank you, as ever, to James Launch for the music. And thank you to our loyal listeners. And if there's any showrunners out there who want to hear their fellow showrunners abused and ruffled around and put under the microscope so you can hear their stories of rejection, failure, and adversity, please send them our way. If you are interested in following us on social media, no, I've lost track.
I am at Ann Evslin on Twitter or X or whatever Elon Musk now calls it. And thanks to Elon Musk, I'm also at Noah Evslin on Hive, Spoutable, Blue Sky, Threads, Mastodon, MySpace, Friendster, and I'm sure 1,000 more.